Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
On a Saturday afternoon, it's John Williams. Hi, you hear me weekdays, I hope, from 9 to noon here on WGN Radio, and now on this Saturday as well with producer Griffin Filipich. We'll get you from here to 3 o'clock this afternoon. Later in this hour, Barry Manilow. Griffin is so excited about this. Big Barry fan, are you?
Absolutely, yeah.
Name three Barry Manilow songs, go.
Copacabana.
Good. So anyway, later in this hour, Barry, from our conversation earlier in the week, we had so much fun, I just want to replay it. But I was so happy because I was talking to him, and I said, did you know that you are the answer to a New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle question this week? And he had no idea. He said, I do that puzzle all the time. I didn't do it this week.
What
I go, dude, you're the answer.
What was the question?
1975 Copacabana Hitmaker. So there you go.
It'd be funny if he couldn't come up with it.
Oh, you know you've arrived when you were an
He's
answer.
He's got like five
that.
Of the letters before he realizes that it's his own name.
Oscars are this weekend, tomorrow night at 7 o'clock Chicago time on ABC. Griff, you follow movies more closely than I. Let's talk a little bit about it here and then again in the next hour.
Yeah.
What are you looking forward to?
It's hard to say because there's no host and, you know, built-in moments for the Oscars. There aren't that many that you find yourself looking forward to, except for, you know, one thing you know is going to be there are the nominated songs for Best Song. In terms of the show that they're putting on, that's kind of, you know, it's a category that people don't care about that much, but and yet it is crucial to the telecast. That's a category that people don't care that much about, but it's crucial to the telecast that those songs are good for performing in front of a big audience. I guess that's one thing that I would consider looking forward to, but the songs they picked are really bad, and they left out some really good ones. So I guess Elton John performing, that'll be a big deal.
Yeah, right, right,
I don't really know what I'm looking forward to. I'm not Brad Pitt. I might probably win. I think he'll give a good speech, but you don't know who's going to be up there, so it's hard to say, especially because there's no host. You don't know, you know, that's not something that you can necessarily look forward to either.
Are you glad they don't have a Ricky Gervais or somebody up there?
It worked really well last year with no host, so I don't see why it couldn't again this year, but we'll see.
Best Picture? So let's just start with a few of the categories, then we can maybe get into more of them a little later on, but when I said, what are you looking forward to, I assumed it would be the Best Picture category.
I'm expecting to be a little dismayed by this one, as is usually the case. 1917 is the front runner in this category. The Sam Mendes movie about World War I. It's shot to look as if it's all one take. You know, I'm sure many people have already seen it by now.
I have not, and I know that much about it. Does that work, by the way? The idea that it's one take, does that add some unique dimension to the movie?
Unique, sure, yeah. You know, not many movies are shot like that. Birdman, actually a previous Best Picture winner, is the last example of that I can think of doing it for a whole movie. The last high-profile example, anyway.
And I thought it was very clever and entertaining in Birdman. I mean, mm-hmm. Some of the things you go, wow, how is this happening? Did you have that sense?
Well, and of course it's not one take, to be clear. We all know, you know, maybe some people aren't super clear on that.
Well, whatever movie magic they do.
Right. They find places that they can cut and stitch together. You know, digitally you can do about anything now.
It's amazing.
So, but yes, it does look... Yeah, no, that is an achievement in its own right. It doesn't make it a good movie, though. And I don't think it's a bad movie, but I think it is lacking in some other places.
Okay, so Best Picture then. But
I do think that will win. The only possible upset that it seems like right now that people are talking about anyway is Parasite, which is a movie I loved. I think Joker maybe has a chance to sneak in and steal, but that's just a hunch that I have that I don't see anyone else saying. This is an interesting race between Parasite and 1917. If you were talking about the Oscars, you know, coming up next year, if you're talking about them last summer, you would think big opuses like The Irishman and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from two of the most important directors of their living directors, Martin Scorsese and Quentin Tarantino, you'd think that they were probably duking it out with each other for this prize. And they are not in the conversation at all. It would be a huge surprise if either one of those came. And that's just a bizarre thing that happens. That's why the Oscars are interesting and sometimes infuriating, is that we're at a place right now where it seems like 1917 is a lock. And you know, a month ago. No one even knew anything about it.
What's the movie that you enjoyed the most this year?
Of the nominees, it's Little Women or Parasite, probably. I think it's a pretty strong set of nominees, though.
Irishman was fun to watch. And
I loved Irishman.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and I loved Marriage Story also. So those five, and then the Best Picture nominees to me are kind of broken up to those five and then the other four, which I'm not as crazy about. But none are horrible, you know?
Okay, so let's do this.
There's usually a horrible one.
And at least we don't have that. What was the one where they danced with the fish a few years ago?
And we'll talk more about that later.
That's all coming up. This is WGN. 720 WGN. John Williams grew up in a house with Barry Manilow records. He's still putting them out.
For I knew that I was blessed when I was just like the rest of the people who never let dreams in their minds. Music would play and say, maybe you're wasting your time.
He's on the phone, but now I want to listen to the song.
Would play and say, hey, what a dummy you are.
Mr. Manilow, what should we do? Listen to the whole song or should we talk to you? Your thoughts.
Oh, God, I haven't heard it in so long. What a wonderful song that was.
Really, I was wondering if your songs are all like your babies and you love them all the same, or do you have one or two that are your favorites?
Well, you know, I sing the hits in Vegas every night. And, you know, it's wonderful. The hits are just great, and the audience loves them. But, you know, there are these album cuts that pop up, like what you just did, that I've forgotten about. And, you know, they just bring back memories, and I'm so proud of the writing of these songs and the performance and the production. Really, I don't pay attention to them as much as I should.
What would you say, then, is your greatest craft? Singer, songwriter, composer, producer? I mean, you've had a hand in all of those places. We all know you wrote jingles for companies years and years ago. What is it that made Barry Manilow Barry Manilow?
I think the thing I do that nobody else does is I'm an arranger. That's what I wanted to be Nelson Riddle when I grew up. I wanted to take songs that either I wrote or other people wrote and flip them around and make them even more and find different facets to them. And that's what I do best. I did it for Bette Midler, you know, on Do You Want to Dance, you know, that old rock and roll song, and we made it into a ballad, and it turned into a big hit record. And anyway, that's what I do, and that's what makes me different than all the other singers, because I love doing arrangements of songs, whether they're my own or whether they're the outside material.
Maybe that explains this. We were talking before you came on, Barry, about an interview you gave the New York Times last year, and they said this: audiences in your shows are always giddy. When you perform, are you also having a good time? And you said, I never have a good time. I'm working. I kind of bleed up there. Are you going to stick with that answer? Is that a fair representation?
Well, you know, I have a good time is just an odd way of putting it. I mean, when the show is over and I actually, you know, the audience is happy, as long as they're happy, then I am having a good time. But it's a job. It's a real, I'm committed to making these audiences have a great time. Well, that's what I think of. I don't think of having a good time. I think of making them happy. Well, you know, it's not about me being happy. It's about them being happy. So am I having a good time? Well, I guess when it's over, I look back and say, I guess I had a good time because they were happy.
I get that. I think that answer makes sense. But this also makes sense. Don't do it anymore. Have you ever thought, heck, I don't have to work anymore. I'm Barry Flippin' Manilow.
Well, I could do that. I couldn't. I just couldn't stop. I think I would probably croak if I stopped. I'm just a creator, you know? I just have a million ideas all the time. I'm working on the next album now. You know, I'm changing the show in Vegas around. I'm just filled with ideas. The well hasn't run dry yet, thank goodness.
Is it hard, though, for a person late in his life to still write great songs? It seems like the songs we know and grow up with were written by people in their 20s or 30s or teens, for that matter.
But they don't write as good as I do.
So that never goes away, right? Like, maybe a person's voice changes, maybe their energy changes, but the ability to know a song in your head is still there, huh?
Right. You know, I can't say that, you know, my writing are hit songs, because nobody can say that except for Diane Warren. But nobody can say that. You know, you can write, I think I'm going to write a hit song. It's impossible. But I can write a pretty good song, and that's about as far as I can take it. And that I can still do.
On paper, do you know, though, when you do write a hit, do you say, I didn't set out to write a hit, but, oh, this one is going on the charts?
Well, no, I've always been very bad at that. I couldn't spot a hit song. You know, I wouldn't know how to do that. But, you know, I can write something and then I walk away from it for a day. And when I come back, then I can say, oh, now, it wasn't as good as I thought it was when I was writing. Or, yes, it's still working for me.
Barry Manilow's on the phone. He's got a new album out. I'll feature that in just a minute. But give me an example of a song, though, Barry, that surprised you, that you didn't know how well it was going to do.
Copacabana.
All right, now everybody's playing that in their head. Here at the Copacabana. So, I know you for that song. You wrote that song as well. That was original for you?
Yeah, sure.
And you didn't think that was going to work? Shoot, I could have told you that was a hit.
No, and Clive Davis, you know, who was the genius of what's going to be a hit song, didn't like that song. And he thought it would be great on the Sonny and Cher novelty show. And, you know, I thought, oh, well, you know, it's just a novelty song, but I'll put it on the album anyway because it's fun. So I had no idea that this song could ever be a hit. And Clive, you know, didn't release it as a single, but it began to creep up the charts by itself because record stations began to play it and get requests. And little by little, Copacabana started to go up the charts by itself because the public liked it that much.
It's such a fun song.
Yeah. Well, now it makes perfect sense, but back then, maybe it didn't feel like a hit song. I don't know.
By the way, Bob's on line one and had a question for you about another one of your songs. Bob, you're on WGN with Barry Manilow. Hi.
Hey, Barry Manilow, this is Bob Erickson. My daughter was born in 1975, and we heard your song, Mandy.
Uh-huh.
However, I made a mistake of calling her Mandy. So her name now is Mandy Ann Erickson instead of Mandy.
How did you screw that up, Bob?
Really, Bob?
I know.
Your name is, it's a lovely name, but did you think I was singing Oh Mandy?
Yeah,
oh,
I really did.
I
think my Brooklyn accent made that happen?
So technically, this is your fault, Barry Manilow.
To it again. Do I sound like I'm singing Oh Mandy?
All right, Producer Olive, grab the song. We'll settle that here right once and for all right now. Thank you for the call, Bob. That's a wonderful story.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you, Barry.
Our best to your daughter, Mandy. You know, thanks for the phone call. The version I heard of that, though, Barry, I'm sure you've told this story a million times, was that it was not originally a song about Mandy anyway. It was about Brandy or somebody else, right?
It was called Brandy. It was a rock and roll song that Clive found in England, and it was a rock and roll song, and he gave it to me to record, and I thought, really? Me? A rock and roll song? I found a love song in it. And here I go back to being an arranger. I took this rock and roll song and found the love song in it, and that was the record. I took this thing that they didn't expect to work, and I made it into a ballad and, you know, changed the key and made a big ending and added violins to it, and it became the Mandy that we know now. But that's what an arranger does, and that's what happened with Mandy. Brandy.
I think you said Mendy there, Barry.
Yeah, I think I hear it. I hear it. It's my fault.
My bad. Do you later in life? I keep saying later in life. I'm surprised how energetic and able you are as a person who's in his 70s.
Stop, please. I am as old as the frickin' hills, but I look fabulous, and
you do.
I'm still, you know, full of energy and still creating, and I don't know.
Well, that's my point. So do you find, though, that there are certain themes in your mind, in your life, that you write about now that are different, maybe? What are you writing about in your new album?
Well, there's just so many things you can write about in a song. I can't write, you know, I didn't go to the bathroom today, or, you know, it doesn't make good for a lyric, you know? So there's just so many things you can write, and certainly for pop songs, all you got is I love you, I miss you, and come back to me. But, you know, I do try to go further away from that. We wrote a song called Touched by an Angel, and it's a beautiful song, great, real big, and that's the next album, by the way. And, you know, it's about somebody who's inspiring to them. That you can still write about.
By the way, I don't know if you saw the New York Times Sunday crossword puzzle. You are the answer to one of the questions in the Sunday New York Times crossword puzzle. I don't know how many awards you've had in your life, but you've finally made it now, Barry. You're in the New York Times.
You know, I do the New York Times crossword puzzle. I didn't do it. Is it on this last Sunday?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so excited.
And by the way, the question is about the Copacabana. It's like he's the Copacabana guy. And
oh, my God.
The answer is Manilow.
All right, I'm hanging up on you right now.
In that case, thank you, Barry. Congratulations on a great career. And really, the new album is terrific as well.
I make a date for God, and you can bet your life it rains.
This time last week, it was, who's going to win the Super Bowl? I'm John Williams. This time this week, it's, what ad did you like the best? Turns out the ad meter winner was produced right here. That Jeep commercial with Bill Murray, where he brings back his TV weatherman role from Groundhog Day. Longtime TV ad man and now consultant Bill Cimino talked to me this week about what makes a good ad. Here's part of that phone conversation. Most of us watch commercials and we either fast forward through them because we don't like them, or go do something else, or it's the Super Bowl and we watch them and maybe pay more attention to them. Must be different for somebody like you, right? When a commercial comes on, do you watch it differently than I do?
You know, oddly, I'm pretty much the same as you, I guess. If I lose interest with it, I will turn the channel just like everybody else, or I'll fast forward. You know, it's the really good ones that I'll lean into, and personally, I get enjoyment, and then just professionally, I try to deconstruct how they came up with the idea, et cetera. I love advertising.
Well, what's a good commercial?
Well, it's one that engages you in a meaningful way. It makes you think a little bit differently about a brand, and you walk away. For me, it's always been that talk value thing. Is it good enough to share? Did it make such an impression that you think it's really funny, or it moved you in some way, or, you know, or in the worst case, it pissed you off or it bored the hell out of you?
Well, I know you were behind the Real Men of Genius campaign. We'll get to that in a minute. But just speaking of Bud Light, the campaign they have where they have the knights and it's these royal court scenes. I like that campaign. I presume you do, too.
You know, initially I did. I think they had something going with the Dilly Dilly thing. And for whatever reason, it's kind of jumped the shark a little bit for me now. I mean, I kind of feel it was a little derivative of the Game of Thrones stuff. There was a lot of buzz about that. And it certainly was timely. But lately, I certainly didn't like the mashup they did with Tide and the commercial. I didn't know what to do with that. It was a little confusing, and I didn't get a kick out of the overall impression that it left me with.
Yeah, I noticed that too. That is my impression of that campaign, where early in the Super Bowl broadcast, somebody gets a stain on his shirt, and then throughout the rest of the broadcast, he's trying to get the stain out of his shirt. It was Pete from Always Sunny in Philadelphia. He's a funny guy. A colleague of mine tweeted, "Wow, they found a way to make him not funny." But then the running gag on the props to you, Steve Cochran. So, and then the conceit was throughout the rest of the broadcast, we'll see what happens to this stain. I didn't buy in. I wasn't there at the beginning, and I wasn't there at the end.
Yeah, totally. I lost interest. And furthermore, I was like, I started to think about Tide. I'm like, well, geez, don't they have that, like, stain remover that works really fast? What are you saying about your products here? I don't know. It kind of was a rabbit hole of a variety of things that I couldn't invest any more interest in it.
Is the Super Bowl a bigger stage, and are the stakes higher? I think I know the answer to that, but then how does that change the thought process and the production process of a commercial?
Well, that's a really good question. Yes, absolutely changes the whole dynamic. Those commercials, 30-second spots somewhere in the neighborhood of, just to place the media, is what, $5.5 million or somewhere in that neighborhood, which is a ton of money. Definitely, I think brands should put their A game on. And I think when brands don't do a good job and they just want to put something on the Super Bowl and it's not good, it can do more harm than good.
Give me some examples of some of your spots you've done that I would recognize.
One that took the number one spot on AdMeter, and at the time, AdMeter, or it still is, a significant arbiter of what is considered the best or what people like the most.
Sure.
And a lot of clients invest a lot of, a lot of clients, at least back in the day when I worked on Anheuser-Busch, it was a huge deal. They really wanted to win that thing every year. But maybe the last one I got number one on was a spot called Satin Sheets, and it was a pretty simple construct. Young married guys caught up in a game, and his wife is trying to entice him to come upstairs, and she says, you know, hey, honey, I put the black teddy on, and he's sort of ho-hum, and she's like, put the satin sheets on the bed, and then he's still not really interested, and she's like, I got cold Bud Light, and he runs up the stairs, and he jumps on the bed and slides out the window, and, you know, sort of comedic hilarity ensues.
I've got cold Bud Light.
Ow.
Honey?
Make it a Bud Light. That did really well on that game, and it was pretty fun.
You know, but isn't that funny, though? I mean, okay, this is the Super Bowl of commercials. It's a major global brand. What are we going to do? How are we going to sell it? I know, let's have a guy run upstairs and slide out the window and hilarity ensues. Put that way, too simple or too easy. Maybe for you guys, what you just said represented weeks of sweat and toil, you know?
You know, what's interesting is when they judge those things, I don't know if it's done the same way, but, you know, sort of all the data that is, you know, collected, people react at different moments of the spot. And that spot had what worked for that, you know, I don't know if it's the funniest idea ever, but, you know, in terms of execution, we pulled it off really well. But timing was of the essence of that, and how it played out, and, you know, how the music ramped up to sort of a crescendo, and then, you know, just having the surprising ending. I think that all that came into play. And then, you know, there's one other element that you really don't even take into consideration. I knew the brewery liked that spot, but it was placed in the third quarter, which typically spots rank higher earlier in the game. There's always sort of exclusions to that. But in our case, the fact that it was late in the third quarter, and it was a really good game, so people were still tied into the game, and all these little factors go into play in you know, ultimately giving you the result that, you know, you hope for.
And by the way, I want to just insert one other thing before we go. Your Real Men of Genius campaign, right, where they sing that ridiculous jingle about the real men of genius, and it's guys who are dorks or making manly mistakes, and yet it still sings their praises, however sarcastically. But we all see ourselves in these, the guy with the bad toupee, for instance.
Budweiser presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Really Bad Toupee Wearer.
Mr. Really Bad Toupee Wearer.
I like that campaign for a number of reasons. It's funny. It's relatable. I think it takes some chances because you're associating your product with imperfection. But I like that it's a good radio campaign. Here's my biggest pet peeve in the world. Commercials from TV that they just run the audio on. And I'm sorry, it's hard to do, I think, or just as hard to do a good radio commercial without visuals as a good TV commercial. And if somebody takes the time or demonstrates the craft to do that well, I really appreciate it. That's where I live. And that campaign works that way very well.
That was one of those things that I was so fortunate to be part of. There was a few of us that were on it, probably the longest. My boss, John Amisotti, Mark Gross, myself, and then we had a young writer, Bob Winter, who actually came up with the initial idea, but it was very different. And through collaboration, we came around to it. I remember Mark, wow, these are really kind of funny salutes for these very not great things. And we're, you know, and if you think about how that came to be, Budweiser, I don't know if you remember the old Budweiser spots, but they were really stoic, and it was always about this Bud's for you, and it was always some guy doing something really earnest, and, you know, it's like at the end of the day, someone buys him a beer, and it was, you know, it wasn't funny. It was more emotional and powerful. And we, you know, and Bud Light had this, you know, we always said, oh, Bud Light's kind of the younger, wackier brother of Budweiser. And I was like, well, this makes perfect sense. We're going to do the most ridiculous salutes ever. And that's kind of how it came to be. That was fun. And you know, and it's funny, that campaign just lend itself to the medium so well. It was such, you know, everyone talks about radio being theater of the mind. I mean, that you could have had a more grand theater with trying to describe these goofy people. One other detail of this thing needs to be displayed. When it came initially, the music they had on it was Bette Midler. Was like, somebody ever tell you you're my hero? And it was like this very emotional, and we put that music to it, and it never worked. And I remember my boss, John, was like, you know what this thing needs? This thing needs, like, we got to do, like, the faux rock anthem. Like it's got to feel like Eye of the Tiger from Survivor. And we were like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. And we went to the music house, and this guy, Sandy Toronto, who is our composer, he's like, oh, my God, I have David Bickler. He's the guy that's saying that. Let's get him in. And then we started, you know, creating our own music, which the music was a huge portion of delivering the comedy of those things. So we actually got the lead singer of Survivor to sing that stuff.
That's Bill Cimino. To hear our full conversation and how that went, go to the John Williams page at WGNradio.com. Our podcast is there. Sam Panionovich joins us on a Saturday on WGN Radio. I'm John Williams. I often call on Sam as my our sports wagering expert. I guess you're all of our, Sam. How are you?
I'm doing well. I thought you'd be sick of me by now. Super Bowl's over. What do you want?
Yeah, well, we do have March Madness right around the corner. But I just want to go back for 1 second and talk about what happened last weekend, and that is the Super Bowl. How much money was spent and who won? And give me some numbers on
that. Well, we only have Nevada and we have New Jersey at this point in time, but the numbers are staggering. You look at Nevada Gaming Control Board and their team put out a number that the statewide handle on the game was $154.7 million. Now, context there, that is the second highest total ever on a Super Bowl in Nevada. $154.7 million. And Nevada actually won $18.8 million, so they held 12%. Nevada does it right, though, because they've been doing it forever.
And what do you mean they do it right?
They do it right because
they don't lose?
They know how to shade their numbers, and they have intuition on what you're going to bet. So they are able to move their markets and stay ahead of the curve, where some of these other states are so new to it, they don't know how to book because they haven't booked.
Sam, you're saying that the casinos in Las Vegas made 18% of the money bet. They kept 18%.
18 million, which is 12%.
12%. 12%. But New Jersey's casinos lost money?
And their handle was a lot lower, but still a pretty staggering number and a nice increase from where they were last year. So this is the second Super Bowl in New Jersey. Last year, they were about $35 million in bets taken. This year, New Jersey took 54.2, but they did lose. They lost $4.2 million.
See, I thought that the casinos always won. Like, if it's the slots or if it's blackjack, the casinos always make more money than they lose.
They will lose on certain Super Bowls. Nevada has only lost two in the last 28. So, like I said, Nevada knows what to do, though. And in Nevada, their Rolodex, or their menu, for that matter, is bigger. The more you bet, the more you lose.
So you aren't telling me about just the one bet on who wins or loses.
This is more than just Chiefs or Niners or over or under. This is all the prop bets. Patrick Mahomes, passing yards. Patrick Mahomes, will he score a touchdown? Yes or no? I mean, in Vegas, there were 1,000 different ways to bet the game at one casino.
You know, I had $50,000 on the length of the national anthem and lost it.
That is not true, because you could not bet that much on the length of the anthem.
Oh, really?
There's limits on things like that. Yeah. On the Gatorade, on the coin flip, on the national anthem. We're talking about a maximum bet of probably $500 or $1,000.
I guess that makes sense. But not so on the over-under.
On the game, somebody took, the Westgate in Las Vegas took a $110,000 bet on the Chiefs. Can you imagine betting that much money on a football game?
Are you surprised by that? I mean, I get your point, but it's a crazy world.
Am I surprised by it? No. Would I ever do it? Hell no.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the point. But I guess anybody that bets $100,000 on the Super Bowl has $100,000 to lose.
How about this? So they also came out, American Gaming Association came out with this number. This is the total number for U.S. dollars wagered in American sports books for the whole calendar year 2019. How much do you think it was? Legal sports bets across the country in 2019.
Okay, that's a different number. Legal sports bets for the year across the country, not just the Super Bowl. Well, you just demonstrated for us $150 million on the Super Bowl. I'll say $300 million.
Not that they wish. $13
billion. $13
billion. $13 billion.
And I'll bet $13 billion was wagered illegally as well.
I would say probably double or triple that.
I was just going to say, because I have never wagered legally, and I've wagered illegally many times, because technically every office pool is illegal.
The black market is way bigger than people will ever admit.
But see, this is the thing. You say, okay, well, then the state of Illinois should get in on this, but what if then the, I don't know, is it possible that the state of Illinois, whatever that means, could have lost money on the Super Bowl?
For sure. They certainly could have.
Well, then, so be careful, everybody, before you start counting your tax dollars.
But remember, just because a sportsbook loses one game, how many games do we have in college basketball the very next day? And then we have games on Tuesday and Wednesday. So over the course of a month, and definitely over the course of a year, sportsbooks are going to make money.
Well, actually, and I'm confusing the sports book there, then, aren't I, with the state. That is, the book could lose money, but the income generated by the winners, be it the casino or the individual, the state's going to get that. So the state doesn't care if I win or lose.
The state would rather the bettors lose, because then the state gets the tax.
Because the casino makes the money and they're going to tax them.
So you and I bet $100 each, right? We each bet $100. I win. I get $100. The sportsbook pays me $100. You lose. You lose $100. Illinois will take 15% of that $100 that you lost. And that's where they're going to make their money, on top of the ridiculous licensing fees. And I keep doing all these shows on all these different stations. Well, the bill isn't that bad, and the fees aren't. Are you out of your mind? 15% is, that's the second highest state, Illinois, in tax rate for sports betting. Now, Pennsylvania is ridiculously high. They're 35, 36%. That's insane. So of that 100 that you lost, Pennsylvania takes 35%. But Illinois is looking like, at this point in time, they will have the second highest tax rate, and the license fee is $10 million if you want to go into a casino, it's $10 million, or if you want a mobile book, it's $20 million. Those are exorbitant fees compared to other books across the country.
Those are the fees that they charge the operators to run these
gambling
operations.
To come in, hey, would you like to own a sports book? Would you like to operate a sports book?
And then
$10
million. Okay, I've got $10 or $20 million, but don't worry, I'll make it back but now if I have to pay 15% to the state on what I earn,
plus 2% in Cook County,
17%, then I need to make at least 18% of the year to have a profit. Okay, well, that's a calculation for them. And you think that's a little steep?
I think it's steep, but if you have the money up front, you think big picture. Because, if, yeah, if you're writing a check for $10 million, that's a lot of money. But you have to think more long term. This is not a sprint. This is a marathon. And this is something that if it's done right, and if you could find the money, that $10 million is going to be made up in a couple years. I mean, they look at some of these figures. They project that
That's a one-time fee, isn't
that's
it?
That's a one-time. Well, you have to renew it after 4 years, and it's not $10 million. If you look at the way it's going to shake out, they project the first calendar year, the first 365 in Illinois, that the state will take in about $58 million of profit. Just a drop in the bucket, $58 million. And yeah. I promise you, after the first 365, that number ain't going down. That number's not going to go lower. I bet on this industry. I am going to continue to bet on this industry that people will continue to bet. It's going to be eventually at stadiums. It'll be at United Center. It'll be at Wrigley Field. It'll be at U.S. Cellular, Guaranteed Rate, Comiskey, whatever the hell we're calling it. There will only be more of this. So if that $58 million in year one is a staple, by year two, we could be $75, $80 million for the state.
Sam Panayanovich, you're very enthusiastic about this. You're very knowledgeable about this. But I also get the feeling you're not an enthusiastic wagerer, but you just are into the business. You're into the industry side of it. Fair enough. Do you worry, though, like, are there negative repercussions either for gamblers or the state or the sort of people we're doing business with? Do you see what are your red flags?
Problem gambling. Problem gambling is a serious deal, and not to get too much into it, but I mean, there are things in Vegas that happen that should have never happened with me, and that happens, and you learn from that, and you move on from that. The state has allocated money for problem gaming and problem gambling. It's a part of this huge package that they rolled out. Remember, this sports betting bill was packaged in with other bills, the vertical capital bill. I mean, this is not just a sports betting only bill, Senate Bill 690. It was a part of a much larger bill, but they have allocated money and dedicated part of that budget to helping people that either need help or that are going to need help. And that's the reality. I mean, if you ever hear the commercials for sportsbooks or for DraftKings or for FanDuel, you hear at the end, if you have a problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER. But they play it three times fast forward.
It's like at the end of liquor ads. Mm-hmm. If you know, a problem drinking, call 1-800-ALCOHOL.
Yeah, but they say it's at 1-800-GAMBLER. Okay, got it. But hey, come on down and give little Johnny's college check. By the way, if you have a problem, call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Well, the state already operates the lottery. I mean, that's gambling. Although it's not the same. Will these be brick-and-mortar operations then we're talking about?
You'll have 10 brick-and-mortars, I think, initially. But then you'll also have the... I mean, you go to a lot of DePaul games.
Yeah.
Is the capacity there 17,000?
No, it's about 10 or 11.
Okay. 17,000 is the threshold. If your arena or stadium has 17,000, then you could have a sports book in the stadium.
Really? Yeah. So the United Center could have one.
They will have one. They are building it right now. Wink, wink.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, but then, and then other venues, and would they be the kind of, like a casino where we wouldn't have slots and card?
I think eventually you'll have a window, a counter with tellers that are taking your bets, and you'll also have the mobile iPads like they have overseas in Europe, and you'll have the kiosks. So in 5 years, I envision a world where hot dog, sauerkraut, onions, relish next to the kiosk. There's another kiosk. Bears, -3. And you could literally put the money in and print a ticket.
And then they've got big screen TVs, and you sit there and have your hot dog and watch the game.
Yes, sir.
And either get indigestion or celebrate.
Whichever you choose.
Sam Panayanovich watches the... how do you say your last name, Sam?
Panayanovich.
Adovich. It's a T at the end. Tovich. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yeah.
Hey, do I always say that correctly? And
you
correctly?
Do.
Am I in between?
You're good.
Sam Panayanovich watches the gaming industry for us, the sports gambling side. And it's always a pleasure to visit with him. Thanks, Sam.
Thank you.
I hope you're enjoying this Saturday edition of the John Williams Show. Producer Griffin Filipich and I have another hour for you after WGN Radio News. By the way, at WGNRadio.com or on my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John on all social media, you'll be able to find something that Bob Collins said. Bob Collins was our longtime legendary host here, afternoons and then mornings at WGN Radio. Bob died 20 years ago today in a tragic plane crash, along with two others. And on his final broadcast, he read something about what we all learn through the course of our lives. It was fitting then. It is fitting now, and it's good to hear Uncle Bobby's voice one more time. If you didn't know him, listen to it on our website or on my Facebook page. And if you did used to listen to Bob, you'll enjoy hearing it. Several of us have played it over the course of the week, and each time I think I hear something different in it. There's a lot of wisdom packed in that little three-minute piece that Bob did that day, and you'll be able to find it at WGNradio.com. And again, on my Facebook page, I'm WGN King John on Facebook. Hey, and look at that. Lou Manfredini, our Mr. Fix-It, is going to be honored by the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame. They're having their 11th annual amateur boxing tournament called the Night at the Fights. And Lou Manfredini is going to receive the Italian American Sports Hall of Fame Friendship Award. Nobody's a better friend to people around here than Lou Manfredini. It's a fitting award, and you can still get tickets to see this event, although I heard from Bill Comforti, and he says tickets are really selling fast. They're not that expensive. I honestly don't remember the price. You can buy a table. You can buy them individually. For tickets, call 312-226-5566. It's a night of boxing, which I've never been to before, and they're going to honor Lou Manfredini, and that should be fun. It's food, it's beverage, and there's about a half a dozen rounds. The first bout starts at 7 p.m. The doors open at 6. Brenda and I are going to be there. The Manfredinis are going to be there. I think maybe you ought to be there, too. So join us to not only honor Lou, but to put money into the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame Night at the Fights kitty, because they use this for youth programs. What a good idea. Here's the number to call now, 312-226-5566. You can get your tickets, and we'll see you on February 27th. WGN Radio News is coming up. It's hour number two of the John Williams Saturday Show. Hi, this is John. Produced by Griffin Filipich. Griff chimes in with us, especially when we talk about movies and how can we avoid that this week with the Oscars being tomorrow at 7 o'clock on ABC. By the way, in the last hour, we closed with a conversation with Barry Manilow, and now I've got Barry Manilow songs in my head. Do you replay movies in your head? Like after you see a really strong movie, do you think about it or replay scenes in your head a little bit?
Yeah, sometimes specific scenes, but more just think about it more generally. Like a great movie, I find, sits in my brain for a few days after in some form or another. Sometimes it's scenes, or sometimes it's just generally just thinking about the overall experience. Sure.
You know what an example of that for me was this week, Griff? Mm-hmm. I saw The Assistant, which would be a movie for next year, right?
Yeah, I'm very jealous that you already got to see that.
And got to interview the director, too. And yeah, we had a swell conversation, although I did talk way too much. But she was surprisingly not chatty. Anyway, I thought about that movie a lot. I was so struck by it. I thought, was this a great movie? Or sometimes movies hang in your head for a while.
Well, that's a good sign. If you can't decide whether or not you like it and you are thinking a lot about that, I think that's probably a point in the movie's favor.
What's the best example of that from the nominees for the Oscars this year for you? What's the one that lingered in your head?
Little Women it still lives with me. I saw it like a month ago, maybe.
Isn't that interesting?
And I still think about it all the time. I think Parasite is one that I have only seen it once. I imagine that it will reward repeat viewings. I've heard that from people already, and I think about it a lot. The Irishman, too, especially because that's one. Both of those knocked me out on the first time, so it's not like they needed to prove themselves in the way I was thinking about them later. But The Irishman is, I think, probably the best candidate for something like this, where when I saw it, I was like, yeah, that was really good, but it didn't blow me away. You know, some moments accepted, but for the most part, it's a very workaday movie. I don't think it intends to blow your hair back, but I think about it all the time.
Hmm.
And I think it's become greater in my estimation since I saw it.
For the news, we said, okay, we talked about, or in the last hour, we talked about what you thought were the best pictures this year. You said 1917 is maybe going to win it all.
It's the closest thing to a lock, yeah.
But you weren't satisfied with that. If you had to pick one for best picture, movie you enjoyed the most this year, you said it would have been...
I would pick, you know, Parasite or... But I would be happy with, again, any of those five that we talked about. But I would pick Parasite or Little Women.
What about actor and actress? Is there a category that's really interesting to you this year?
Acting categories usually feel the most like locks. Last year, you saw Glenn Close lose to Olivia Colman in Best Actress, and that was previously thought to be a lock for Glenn Close. So there can be big upsets, but they're usually the easiest to predict, and that seems to be the case this year. I mean, we'll see tomorrow. But yeah, Brad Pitt for supporting actor in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that's as close as you can get to a lock. Laura Dern for Marriage Story for supporting actress also is...
Oh, I'm glad.
seems to be a guarantee.
She was so good in that. That was so much fun.
And then for lead actor, Renee Zellweger for Judy is, I think, the closest thing to maybe vulnerable in this, in the acting categories, but it seems to be a lock. And then Joaquin Phoenix for Joker. Those are your four. And I think those will all probably happen. But
what do you think of Renee Zellweger and Judy?
I think she's really good.
I did too.
I don't love her winning for it, but I think she was very good.
Are you interested in this? I saw a headline this week. Should the Academy worry about Joaquin's speech if he wins? What's that all about?
What do you mean?
Should the Academy be worried about Joaquin Phoenix's speech?
Oh, because he wins. Because he's unpredictable.
But that could be, I mean, who cares? He's an actor. This isn't rocket surgery. Let him talk.
Sure, yeah. But, you know, in the past, he would threaten not to show up to award shows or wouldn't show up and would publicly talk about how stupid they were. So I imagine that's where they were coming from. But he's at the Golden Globes, he was sort of made me uneasy.
Yeah.
But if you've watched his acceptance speeches throughout this award season, he's gotten actually more and more congenial. And his acceptance speech at the SAG Awards where he won was really charming. And then he just accepted one at the BAFTAs, the British Oscars, basically, where he had a political message that maybe wasn't for everybody, but he made it very well and had clearly prepared. So I think he's realizing that he's going to be doing this stuff getting better and better as he goes. So I think it'll probably be a good, really good speech.
Is there something else you're looking forward to? So you've given us actor and actress.
So we didn't talk about director, which is also seems like it's between 1917 and Parasite. So Bong Joon-ho, who's a South Korean filmmaker and basically considered a master at this point. This could be a real coronation for him. Or it could go to Sam Mendes, who has already won Best Director for American Beauty about 20 years ago for 1917. And I think it'll be Sam Mendes. Sometimes picture and director split. So it goes to one thing for director and another thing for picture. So you could see that happen here. I kind of feel like it's going to be a 1917 sweep of those two categories. But that also might be me protecting myself from, you know, getting too invested in Parasite winning one of these big awards, which I would love to see. So,
well, maybe the Oscars have made some progress, or we all have, if Parasite wins, because that's not the kind of movie that Americans have grown up watching.
It'll definitely win International Picture, and it might win a screenwriting award. It would be nice to see it get one of the top prizes for sure. Yeah.
Producer Griff watches more movies than you do, and we always appreciate
not his... necessarily
we always appreciate his commentary on these sorts of things. Still to come, Eric Zorn and Mary Schmeek, Chicago Tribune columnists, talk to us about the viability, the future of the Chicago Tribune. That's all coming up. This is WGN. On Thursdays, we post a podcast called The Mincing Rascals. This week with The Daily Lines, Heather Sharone, the Illinois Policy Institute's Austin Berg, The Tribune's Eric Zorn, WGN Radio's Steve Bertrand, and me, John Williams. So here's part of the podcast. We'll pick it up with Bertrand wondering out loud about how viable presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg is.
I think the country will not vote for a married gay man. I just don't.
And did you see that viral video of the Buttigieg supporter going to caucus for
him? Try to return the vote?
And discover that he's married to a man and just get into it with one of his precincts campaigns.
So are you saying that he has a same-sex partner?
He?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Are you kidding?
Yeah, he's married to him, yeah.
We need to find out if that's serious.
Then I don't want anybody like that in the White House. So can I have my card back? I don't know. Yeah. Find it. We could go ask.
Live on camera.
And then he said, well, he kept it a secret. It's like, well, no, he hasn't kept it.
Well, he doesn't announce it every day.
I also worry about the fact that Buttigieg has only run a relatively small city in Indiana, and he has his executive experience, although Trump had absolutely no executive experience.
Well, you know, and so. I don't know why, Eric, that Buttigieg refers to himself as a mayor of South Bend, why he doesn't refer to himself more as a combat veteran. You know, because there are a lot of...
I don't know that he can claim a combat veteran status.
But he did tours in Afghanistan.
Sure. My brother's a Marine. He's very particular about this sort of thing. Like, whether you're in combat is a very specific
designation. Okay, so veteran who served terms overseas. Yeah. Because, I mean, that got a lot of people elected around the country to Congress. And that helps, too.
John Kerry, unfortunately.
It never comes up, you know, in the first or second sentence about Buttigieg. And I think... The Democrats haven't been talking much about foreign policy anyway, but I don't know why they don't use that more.
I saw a heat map of which counties or precincts went with whom in the Iowa caucus. And I don't know that I know Iowa that well, but Mayor Pete did really well in the outlying areas.
Well, he did. He was basically the only candidate who was organized in the
I guess that's
candidate.
What it demonstrated, because yes. I don't know what Iowans are like, but I was a little surprised to see them embrace a gay man that way. But clearly they did compared to the other candidates.
I thought that maybe one of the big winners on Monday night was Bloomberg. That with Biden dropping so precipitously, and with Klobuchar did, I think, well enough to hang in there. But who's occupying? Buttigieg, is he going to occupy that moderate lane? Is he going to be the one the party's going to go for? Or is there going to be a hunger and an opening when it comes to Super Tuesday for voters who've seen millions and millions of dollars worth of Bloomberg ads to say, you know, let's give this guy a chance. He makes a good point in his ads. I mean, right. And it could be that. The strategy of ignoring New Hampshire and Iowa has never proved to work very well, but I think that it could work this time.
Okay, let's do this. We'll wrap this up. We're leaving Iowa now, and they'll go on to New Hampshire. Well, I'm going to ask you guys the following question, though, and that is, who has the best chance among the Democrats of beating the incumbent? Who has the best chance among the Democrats of winning?
So there's a interesting new political scientist who I've begun following on Twitter, Rachel Bitecoffer, who's profiled in Politico magazine today. And her argument is that essentially whomever the Democrats put up stands a better than 50% chance of beating Donald Trump because of because the way the electorate is likely to be constituted in November.
So any Democrat will win.
That's her argument.
Five,
so who's got the best chance, do you think?
That's the question.
I think New Hampshire will be more important this year than it has been in past years because of the Iowa debacle.
This is a short answer question. Yes. The best chance of winning the
election? I don't know.
Eric Zorn,
The question is best chance of beating the incumbent. That's
yes.
the question.
Yes.
I have put my marker on Klobuchar, and I'm going to leave it there.
Well, that's where mine is, too.
That's funny, because I'm going to say Warren, because I don't consider Klobuchar a potential, but...
Well, that wasn't the question.
That was not the question.
Well,
who
okay.
among them has the best chance of beating the...
Well, economy? I don't like... I think Elizabeth Warren might.
Okay. How
yeah,
about you?
Like Warren, Klobuchar, Yang.
Okay,
Yang.
Thank you for that concise non-answer. You're evidently...
I'm rubbing off on my colleague over here.
Rubbing off on the person sitting to your right. By the way, the person to your right and Eric Zorn have been trading notes. This one from Eric Zorn to me says, hey, Austin is right. This is a total cluster bleep, and I find it hard to follow. They were talking about this last night on WTTW's roundtable, and I was making Scooby-Doo noises the whole time. This is about the what you described as the bizarre saga of how Mike Madigan's office handled sexual harassment allegations. What are you guys talking about?
So, breaking Friday news, last Friday evening, Speaker Madigan's office, there's been a search warrant executed there in Springfield. That's a huge deal. That's the most powerful politician in the state. You have state police there executing a warrant. What was the warrant about? So they were seeking evidence related to potential sexual assault and battery of a former Democratic state representative named Jack Franks.
Of or by? You said...
He was the one who would have committed these crimes,
so
allegedly.
Committed by, okay.
Committed by Franks. Franks left the legislature in 2017. He now serves as the board chairman of the McHenry County Board. And he was a longtime Democratic lawmaker in Springfield. So a number of questions immediately arise, which is, when did Madigan know about any of these potential sexual harassment, sexual assault, battery claims? What does he know, and when did he know it? And so now people are kind of going back. Madigan had to basically come out into the media and establish a timeline of when different things happened. It essentially goes like this. I'll be quick. So in 2018, Madigan's office got evidence of sexual harassment claims going back as far as 2016 from Franks. In February 2019, that complaint was deemed credible, and then Franks was banned from the state house without an escort. This is a sitting lawmaker in Illinois, a board chairman who cannot go into Springfield without an escort because of fear of what he may do.
And all this is happening. We don't know. The public and knows
the public
not a thing
knows
about
zero
it.
About all of this. Then in March 2019, February is when he gets banned without an escort. March 2019, Madigan says he gets new information and goes to the Illinois State Police and tries to facilitate a meeting with the state police and the victim. Then cut to January 2020, police have a search warrant to go into Madigan's office. That's what we know. The big takeaway here, as Eric said, is
All of this was being done to a prominent lawmaker by the Speaker's office with nobody's knowledge, none of the voters' knowledge. And that's the problem, ultimately. I'll talk about a testimony we heard today from the Legislative Inspector General, Julie Porter, who said she had a credible report of serious wrongdoing in the General Assembly, and it was squelched by the Legislative Ethics Commission. That's the problem when you have lawmakers policing each other, is cases like this. You had someone who was a credible sexual harasser whose constituents didn't know about it.
This Franks guy, has he been convicted?
He has not.
He has not been charged. And he denies all of this.
Is he going to be charged?
We don't know. They're clearly investigating. There's a state police investigation.
And the clock's running 3 years on this now, right?
At least.
Four?
Yeah.
Well, it's 2016, so yeah.
And we don't know when the potential criminal activity happened. It's possible that Madigan's office kind of gave him a slap on the wrist for some kind of a harassment complaint that is less serious than these battery or assault charges that are now being discussed.
And the other thing to note is that this is when the whole Me Too scandal is unspooling. This is not...
It didn't unspool in Springfield.
We're talking just like a year ago. That this was all over the news. I can't remember when the Elena Hampton accusations and all that stuff was going around and swirling around Madigan, and how was he handling these things. So if it was only in 2016, you say, well, that's how it was handled back then. But a year ago, we were taking this more seriously. There was more proactivity. And now it's curious that they had to execute a search warrant in Madigan's office.
And imagine during all that firestorm that this happened in Madigan's office and it somehow didn't get out, right?
Well, and not only that, there's the strangeness with the Sangamon County District Attorney criticizing Madigan for releasing these documents to the Sun-Times after a Freedom of Information Act request. That county that includes Springfield says these documents were private. They should not have been released under FOIA, which... is another twist to this
whole thing. The
information that Franks is under investigation and had been banned from the Capitol without an escort.
The search warrant.
The search warrant, essentially.
Why are you so surprised that they're executing a warrant, though, searching Madigan's office? It seems like he's central to all of this, so it makes sense, right?
The surprise, I think, Heather is referring to is the fact that Madigan's office doesn't just release documents when people ask for them. Someone asked for the search warrant that day and got it, or the next week, very soon after. So the question is, why did he keep all of this information quiet before the warrant? And then as soon as the warrant hits, hey, everybody, we just got a warrant. And the district attorney says you should not have released that. And the thought is Madigan doesn't want a headline the next week that says his office was, quote, raided.
He certainly had enough leeway under the Freedom of Information Act request to comply with the Sun-Times request without immediately releasing these documents. And I think that's what the Sangamon County District Attorney is upset about. Essentially, he was like, you shouldn't have released these under FOIA at all, but you certainly shouldn't have done it without consulting with me, since I'm the investigating agency here.
What's the possible crime, or what's the worst wrongdoing that Madigan then is facing here? I mean, he was only knowledgeable about this and didn't say enough about it.
Well, I think that's the fundamental question. Is there another instance of a lawmaker or a high-ranking official, and correct me if you think I'm wrong here, Austin, did Madigan essentially sweep under the rug more sexual harassment claims? Because let's not forget, he lost Tim Brown.
Tim Mapes.
Yeah, so there is a lot going on that Madigan has had to answer for.
And it's odd to me that they had to execute a search warrant if Madigan was ostensibly cooperating with their investigation. And in fact, according to Austin's timeline, I'm trying to follow that he was the one who called some things to the attention of the state police. He's the one who wanted them to escort Jack Franks through the Capitol.
So the question would be, Madigan maybe said, hey, here's some evidence, and the state police says, okay, are you cooperating? Give us this. And they're like, no, we're good with this. And then
even more conspiratorial, is it possible that they said, well, we don't want to just give you this because that might look bad, so can you just get a search warrant and come in and take it so that we don't have to get blamed for
it? Sure, but at the end of the day, it's lawmakers policing lawmakers. That's a huge problem. If only your friendly neighborhood think tank had a bill that would fix this exact thing.
Yeah.
Let's go to Austin Byrne
right
with a suggestion.
So
go.
I'm going to get into my earpiece. It's House Bill 4558. It was just filed yesterday. Chief sponsor is Democrat Jonathan Carroll out of the Northwest Suburbs. It would empower the Legislative Inspector General to be able to release reports of wrongdoing instead of having to go ask other lawmakers whether or not they can release it.
The Rascals go on for about 50 more minutes this week. It's free wherever you find your finer podcasts. This is WGN. Eric Zorn and Mary Schmeek are two friends of mine and friends of yours. They are columnists at the Chicago Tribune, which is maybe on the cusp of more management changes. And what will that mean? I asked Eric and Mary to talk to us a little bit about this news yesterday. Mary, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good morning, John. Well, you know, we tune into your show so that you can tell us what things mean.
No. I'm a bit of a columnist, but not of your stature. And I was just reading about what happened yesterday. Can you just give us the headline, Mary, and walk us through what you heard and how you heard it? And did you see it coming?
Well, Tim Knight, who is a longtime CEO of the company, sent us an email and announced that he was stepping out of that job, and someone new who's also been with the company was stepping into it, and no one saw it coming. I mean, certainly no one at my level saw it coming. I think even some people at a higher level than me were surprised by this. Tim has been with Tribune in various capacities for a long time. He's a guy who cares about journalism, and, you know, in a rocky time where even people who care about journalism have to make decisions that upset a lot of people.
So he enjoys the support of the staff. He's one of you.
Well, no.
Okay.
I mean, the truth is, you know, nobody in management is exactly one of us, right? But he is a guy that, you know, a lot of us certainly have believed understands journalism, cares about journalism, and his departure coincides with the arrival of some people from Alden Capital Management, and I can't remember their exact title, the hedge fund that now has, I think, 32% share of Tribune Publishing. And so, you know, we're just sitting around speculating in the newsroom. We honestly don't know. But this has something to do with the encroachment of Alden, which nobody in our newsroom likes or respects or knows. I mean, one of the weird things about Alden is if you read the stories, it's referred to as a secretive hedge fund. If you try to find a website for them, you can find one. There's no information on it. I mean, people know who they are, but they're very cagey, and they have a history of going in and buying significant portions of newspaper companies and then doing things that have earned them the title of vultures, liquidators, strip miners. They are not beloved in the newspaper industry.
Mary Schmeek, the Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist at the Chicago Tribune, is on the phone. And Eric Zorn, your colleague and a friend of mine who's on our Mincing Rascals podcast each week, is also on the phone. Hi, Eric. How are you?
Hey, everybody.
Yeah. About that company, Mary was just alluding to the website. So we thought, okay, let's reach out to these people that want to run our beloved newspaper or own it and dictate the management. And when you go to their website, it's a landing page. That's all. No links,
yeah.
No contact us. It's the sort of amateur page you or I could put up in 10 minutes. It's bizarre to think that a company, a fund, as resourceful as they must be to be able to buy the Chicago Tribune, has no information about them. I mean, for goodness sakes, if you want to run the Tribune, great, more power to you. Who are you? What are your objectives? Who are your shareholders? Tell me something about yourself. It's just a page that says nothing.
Yeah, we do know that they own the Denver Post, San Jose Mercury, and the St. Paul Pioneer Press, and a bunch of other smaller papers. I've checked out the websites of those of the Post and the Pioneer Press and those places, and the judging from those, I haven't actually seen the print product, but the publications are vastly diminished. They don't have a lot of commentary or analysis. They don't have a lot of – they have sort of basic local news, but it's the kind of thing that you would see sort of in a smaller town, you know, a town of about – like I grew up in Ann Arbor, Michigan. It was kind of like the Ann Arbor News. was 15, 20 years ago. Just a paper without a lot of ambition, just trying to sell some ads and tell you what happened at the city council meeting, but nothing that speaks to any ambition at all. And it's very troubling to see those pages and wonder if that's what they have in mind from the Tribune.
You guys, I still don't understand how it makes sense to buy a paper, then strip its most valuable resources, like reporters and columnists, the people that do the news. Because doesn't that mean then people will be more upset with the paper? They'll be less likely to subscribe to or advertise in it. That means the paper gets less money. How is that a money-making proposition?
Maybe Eric understands the economics of all of this. I don't. I mean, you know, I've read some stories about all that this talk about how they, you know, they buy these properties to sell, you know, properties being newspapers, what we would call newspapers, properties, and they find assets that they can sell. And they, you know, buy newspapers and then sell off the real estate. Now, we already don't have Tribune Tower. I mean, so that the real estate that they once might have profited from, previous owners have profited from.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it's really complex. We do not understand what's going on. And, you know, I want to say, even though there's a temptation to talk about this in doomsday times, the fact that we don't understand it means, I think, that we have to cross our fingers that this is, maybe they're not going to do here what they've done other places. There's no precedent for believing that, but...
Mary, do you know, or Eric, do you know, is this politically driven? Are they liberal or libertarian or conservative? I mean, would they do to a newspaper something that would actually flavor the commentary or coverage?
My sense, John, is that they are not red or blue, but green, that they are all about how much money they can suck out of an institution like ours, and that they don't really think of us as a newspaper so much as they might think of us as a ball bearing factory or something. We make a product, they sell it for a certain price, and if they can cut their costs low enough and continue to keep their profits up, that's what they're interested in. There's no sense that I have from anything I've ever heard about Alden Global Capital that they are in the newspaper business. People were talking about, you know, 10, 11 years ago, Sam Zell, the local real estate magnate, bought the Tribune, and people were saying, well, this is a terrible thing, and it certainly turned out to be bad, but Sam Zell at least had ideas about journalism. He at least had aspirations. They weren't sensible, and they didn't work out for him, but at least he cared about journalism in his way. I don't have the feeling that Alden Global Capital thinks of us as anything other than a factory of some sort, and that they're going to figure out a way to cut the cost as much as possible. And as long as they can keep people subscribing out of habit, then they can do that. I think that the competitive environment here in Chicago is going to make it a lot harder for them to do that. If you've got a town, a smaller town like St. Paul or Denver, maybe, where the people don't have the options, they don't have a Sun-Times, they don't have a ProPublica, they don't have Daily Line,
Daily
they don't
Herald.
Have those kind of, the yeah. Daily Herald, they don't have those things, that maybe they say, well, okay, I guess I'll just keep getting the paper, even though it kind of sucks. But they can't do that here, because people will leave the Tribune and go to other places if they strip it down enough. So Mary and I have, I think, the same thought on this, which is that maybe they will look at the business environment here and think, well, we can't do in Chicago what we've done elsewhere.
Actually, we're getting some calls and texts about this, and you may have one as well. 312-981-7200. You know Eric Zorn and Mary Schmeek. You love them. Did you see them sing Christmas songs at the Songs of Good Cheer? These are not just journalists. They're not just commentators. I think they're just integral parts of our community. And I feel that way about the Chicago Tribune as well. And here, in a way, I compete with them, right? We're a media outlet that's looking for some of the same ad dollars and ears and eyes that they are. But I think we all do better if we all do better in this case. And I just think it's not a ball-bearing factory. If we lost the Chicago Tribune or the Chicago Sun-Times, I think our community would be much diminished. So I'm going to wave the flag for these people and wear my bangs down, the way Heidi Stevens said yesterday. Do you follow her on Twitter? Let's pause for a quick second and then take your questions and comments. 312-981-7200. Here's some of your texts after this. The publisher stepped down at the Chicago Tribune yesterday, and we were wondering what that means. Eric Zorn alluded to some of this in a recent Mincing Rascals podcast, this June deadline where Alden Capital will have more financial control over the Chicago Tribune and what happens then. And is what happened yesterday one of those first dominoes? So we're talking with a couple of columnists with the Tribune. We asked the management at the Tribune and to join us. They declined, and nobody can seem to find these Alden Capital people. Mary Schmeek is on the phone with us, and so too is Eric. The Chicago Tribune is the paper of record here in Chicago, and the paper as you know it may be in peril. I'm John Williams, and columnists Eric Zorn and Mary Schmeek talk to us this week. Our conversation continues here with my reading them some text messages that came in during our broadcast.
John, it's your show. Go for it.
Can the public buy the Tribune? You know this is managed news. We won't get facts if these other people run it. Could the public, you guys could be the Green Bay Packers of newspapers. Is there something like that? Could the public somehow, everybody chip in? Does that make any sense, Eric?
No, I think it doesn't actually make sense as a, I mean, it's a publicly held company. The public could all chip in and buy stock, but that's not really how that kind of thing works. What the model that we're thinking of, we're hoping for, is that either some consortium of wealthier investors decides, or some local people decide they want to invest in the Tribune as a civic asset, and that's certainly what our colleagues Gary Marks and David Jackson called for in their op-ed in the New York Times. They said, we need somebody local, someone with some deep pockets who is willing to come in and fund the operation. The Sun-Times is owned by a group of business leaders and union people who came in to rescue the paper a few years ago. So it can happen, but I don't think the public can do it. That would go against what I know about how business works.
I'm waiting for Mary to write the column that makes that perfectly worded appeal to Oprah Winfrey. And
well, I did write a column making an appeal to a civic-minded owner. Oprah has not stepped forward. But, you know, one thing that's happened as this crisis, I hesitate to call it a crisis, but I think it is a crisis, has come upon us, is the outpouring of support from readers. I mean, there are always going to be the naysayers, right? But I've heard, other reporters have heard, from so many people who just understand what is at stake here. And can I read you a snippet of one of my favorite letters? I mean, really, I've gotten just scores of these letters, but one of my favorites is from a woman named Margaret, who wrote to say, you know, she'd grown up on a Kansas wheat farm and that her mother pushed education and they always had newspapers in the house. And then she wrote, but access to information and education can be taken away from us as citizens. We are seeing the threat more and more to journalists and the free and independent press. And she said, I live on a modest income and I will reprioritize my budget to help. Just broke my heart. And she said, I will be hoping and praying and encouraging all the creativity your staff can muster so that you will still be here well into the future to hold us accountable, to inform, entertain, inspire, and prod us to be our best, to keep us knit together as a widespread, varied, but still connected community. It's exactly right.
You got any texts that are better than that, John?
Nope. Although I do have some that are pretty good. Love, respect, Mary and Eric. We are subscribers, but may quit if Alden guts the paper. Think about that, guys. So if people don't like what happens to the Tribune, I wonder what a subscriber is to do. Should I say, then fine, screw it, I'll cancel my subscription? Or should I continue to subscribe, but then tacitly endorse what these people are doing?
That's a tough call, because I know that no matter what happens, there are going to be some of our friends and colleagues who are left behind trying to do the best they can with whatever resources they're left with. And I hesitate to call for anyone to strip those people of their livelihoods just because others have lost theirs. On the other hand, you have to send a message to people around the country, business investors around the country, that you can't just come in and do this and expect people to keep subscribing, keep paying money when you have severely diminished their product.
John,
but I also think, you know, you have to ask yourself, is this providing me with something that's useful to me? So, you know, even though the Tribune doesn't have the resources that it did when Eric and I started, it still does a lot of really great work. I think it provides a lot of service and entertainment, all the things that you want from a newspaper to people. So the fact that it's not what it was in 1992, you know, I would hope wouldn't be reason for people to cancel. So I think that's a question people just have to ask themselves. Am I still getting enough of value out of this? It's worth paying for.
I think what gets lost too is that, I mean, I don't know who needs to care about the following point, but if you lose the Tribune, electronic media loses too, and social media loses too. People that are posting things are often posting it from paid reporters at the Tribune. Radio and TV right. stations read the paper every day, 24 hours a day now, to see what the Tribune is saying. So all of the news gathering, the amateurs, the commentators, and those of us that are your competition are all kind of feeding off, you know, the top of the triangle is the Chicago Tribune. Put the Sun-Times one step below. We all need a viable and aggressive Chicago Tribune. 773 said, John, please bang the drum loudly on what Alden will do to the Tribune. This is a huge issue for the entire Chicagoland community and the Midwest in general. Are either of you worried at all? I mean, several of you in print and on social media have been very critical of what's happening. Do you worry that one of these unseen faces at Alden Capital is going to see that and it will personally have repercussions for yourselves?
You know, I speak for myself. I don't worry about that. We're in a union, and so they would have a difficult time going after individuals for things like that. And second of all, again, I just think that I don't think they're thinking in those kind of granular terms. They are reading the balance sheet right to left. They're looking at what people are making and trying to erase those budget lines. And I don't think they're sensitive people. I don't think that they're like, oh no, they're disrespecting our view of American journalism. These are money people. They don't really care what the ball bearing manufacturer, the guys working on the ball bearing line in the factory, think about them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is some wish that they could be shamed, but there is no indication that they can be. And, you know, like Eric, I don't worry personally, and that's why we're, you know, speaking out candidly to you here. But we have the luxury of not fearing for our jobs to the extent that we're not 30 years old, we're not 40 years old. I mean, we want to keep our jobs, clearly. But we're not as just vulnerable in terms of life stage as the younger reporters are. And that's one reason we're speaking out. It's for the younger reporters. You know, it's for the city. It's for the newspaper industry. But it's also for these great younger colleagues of ours who, you know, are the people who are going to do it for the next generation.
Yeah.
It's why Mary and I were really out front in the union effort, which was not something that I think we're going to personally benefit from. But we really believe that the power, the strength of the staff, the younger reporters, and continuing to make journalism a viable career path is so important to our city and so important to this field that we needed to take a leadership role, even though, again, you know, we're not in a position to make more money because we're in the union or we're getting toward the end of our career. So we're not, this is all about the future. This is about 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now in Chicago. What does the journalism landscape look like? How are we getting our information? How are we holding the rascals to account in City Hall?
Yeah, I love that. It's 10:54. I've got just a minute left or so. Eric, you commented in our podcast, The Mincing Rascals, about some of the timeline things here. Is it the end of June that some of this, the financing of this thing changes?
Yeah, what happened is that Alden Global Capital has a 32% stake in Tribune Publishing, and they bought that in November. And part of the deal that they worked out to get some seats on the company board, they expanded the board. But part of that deal, they restricted themselves from increasing their stake until June 30th. And on June 30th, the handcuffs come off, essentially, and they can go in and try to buy a controlling share of the company. And then once they do, once they get over 50%, they can dictate the terms of all the budgets. They can say, at that point, all the defenses are gone. Right now, they have a third of the company, but they can't unilaterally act against us or against the staff at that point. And we'll also see on July 1st, assuming that they do make this play for the rest of the company, well, how strong our union is. We're still in contract negotiations, and we're trying to protect, again, we're trying to protect some of these younger and mid-career reporters from having to leave.
If you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper. I guess that's all. That's my saying on the radio. And patronize the sponsors of local talk shows. But I mean, seriously, guys, the only thing I guess I can do as a subscriber citizen is subscribe and patronize, right?
Yeah, and let us talk stuff out on your show, which we appreciate greatly, John.
I appreciate your candor. Thanks. And by the way, if you get a phone number for anybody at all, then I'll throw them on, but I just haven't had any luck yet. So use all of your investigative resources, Mary and Eric, and get back to me on that, okay?
All right, John.
Good to hear your voice.
Good talk to you, John.
That's the Trib, Zorn, and Schmeek. As I like to say, if you don't already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper or patronize the sponsors of your favorite local news talk radio station, WGN. Hey, that's it for me, John Williams, on a Saturday afternoon. Remember, you can always listen to me weekdays from 9 to noon and on social media. I'm WGN King John. By the way, if you go to my page at WGNradio.com, go to the station's website, WGNradio.com, and you can click on shows. You'll find my page there. And there you will find my conversation with Peter Greenberg. Peter's coming up here next on WGN Radio after the news. He and I had a real interesting conversation, and you can click on the replay of that, too, if Peter doesn't cover all of this sufficiently in his next broadcast. That's coming up. But we talk about how best to buy an airplane ticket. He says you do it online. You ought to pick up the phone and call. He said there's more tickets available if you call and speak to a human being, then you will find online. And he said the prices are better, too. He explains it. It's an interesting conversation. And, of course, we also talked to him about how safe it feels to travel right now, either on an airplane or to travel on a cruise ship. This coronavirus has people spooked around the world. He puts it into some perspective, and I'll just tell you generally what he says right now. He's getting on that plane, train, or automobile. He said use some simple precautions like take those little handy wipes, and he tells you what to wipe down when you're on the ship or when you're on the airplane. And he had some good ideas. That's at WGNradio.com. Click on the John Williams page, and you can listen to the podcast of our conversation there. Also, just a quick note, we mentioned this earlier, Lou Manfredini, our Mr. Fix-It, is being honored by the National Italian American Sports Hall of Fame. The Night at the Fights is going to be Thursday, February 27th, and Lou Manfredini is going to get the Friendship Award. You can get tickets to the Night of Food and Beverage, Boxing, and an award for Lou that he deserves. For tickets, call 312-226-5566, 312-226-5566. I'll talk to you Monday morning at 9.